Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, Vatican Radio. And I'm about to join scripture scholar, Archbishop of Brisbane, Mark Coleridge, as he recounts for us the story of one of the greatest of the kings of Israel. He's David.
We all like to have at least friends, but better still, family in high places. I want to introduce you today to one of the members of our family tree of faith, who is in a very high place because he's remembered as the greatest of the kings of Israel. And the man I refer to is, of course, David. He lived about 1000 BC, and he was the youngest son of a man called Jesse, who lived in Bethlehem. From his earliest days, it seems he was known for his good looks. He's described in the Bible consistently as ruddy, which may not be your or my sense of good looks, but in those days to be ruddy was to be considered rather a dasher. He was also, it seems, a good musician, and it was his music that first caught the ear of the first king of Israel, Saul. And David enters the service of King Saul as his squire, we would say. He becomes a great friend of the crown prince, Saul's son Jonathan, and eventually he also marries Saul's daughter, Michal, so he becomes not only squire, but also son-in-law, so close to the first king. David always had that sense of power and keeping close to the powerful. Not only was he ruddy-faced and a good musician, he was also, it eventually transpired, a tremendous fighter. And it was really as a warrior that he made his reputation and staked his success. We all know the story of David and Goliath, but way beyond that, David very quickly builds a mighty reputation as a man of war, a man of great courage, but also of great military sense and strategy. He becomes so successful that King Saul begins to become jealous of him, and in fact, Saul more and more plummets off into a kind of mad paranoia as David's popularity grows. You have to say, though, that Saul's paranoia wasn't completely groundless, because what begins to emerge of David is that there's more than a touch of the scheming opportunist about him. Eventually, however, Saul's paranoia reaches the point where he wants to kill David, son-in-law and squire and all that, but he wants to get rid of him because he sees him as the great opponent and threat. David then becomes a fugitive, and not just a fugitive, he becomes a bandit who gathers around him a group of professional soldiers who will remain loyal to him throughout his very, very long career. He also becomes, I'm afraid to say, an extortionist, because as a bandit, he was also prepared to offer protection to the rich when it suited him. But if they didn't pay, David was also prepared to raid them. Even worse, in some ways, he offers his services to the Philistines, who more and more were looming as the great enemy of Israel. So when the opportunity presents itself, David had no scruples, and this was never forgotten, and only aggravated Saul's sense of paranoia. In one of the great battles with the Philistines, Saul and Jonathan are slaughtered with most of the army of Israel. There's a power vacuum. And the leaders who have survived recognize in David, with his military prowess, the kind of skill and the kind of personal force and leadership qualities that they need in this desperate moment. They come to David, who's down in Hebron, and they offer him the kingship, the throne. And David, of course, reacts with this mock surprise and humility. Who am I? However could this have happened? How extraordinary. Whereas there were many who were saying this was exactly what David had sought to engineer. He accepts the throne, he sees the need for a new capital to symbolise a new unity, and he takes Jerusalem. So for the first time in human history, that fateful city enters the scene. It was just a mountain fortress in neutral territory, so Jerusalem becomes his capital. He then wages war against his old mates, the Philistines, and he defeats them spectacularly. And this is really the beginning of the true grandeur of his military career. It's a career that enables him to build a mini-empire at the time, a time when the empires of Mesopotamia and Egypt were weak at the same time. And in that vacuum, David begins to build his mini-empire. As the story in Scripture runs on, though, he emerges more and more as a man who could run an empire but couldn't run his own family. And this is where he falls. So often in Scripture, what you find is a clash between the public persona and the private person. How often do you find that in life? Examples: his eldest son, the crown prince, Amnon, rapes his own half-sister Tamar. Tamar was the daughter of another of David's many wives than Amnon was. Amnon is then killed by his next brother, Absalom, as an act of revenge. Absalom, who had become, therefore, the crown prince, mounts a rebellion against the aging King David and is himself killed, even though the king is absolutely heartbroken when Absalom is killed. But Absalom had to be killed for the sake of the state. But David was more interested in affairs of the heart. So Absalom goes down in the dust. Then you have Adonijah, the crown prince, the next boy in the line. And he also seeks to usurp the throne from his aging father. And he, in time, is murdered. So what you find increasingly with the great figure of David, this reign that began in unshadowed glory, ends in pathetic defeat and disaster, as the old king has to mount the royal donkey and flee from the capital before the forces of his own sons. So contradictions are rampant in this most fascinating of biblical characters. On the one hand, you find him a violent and unscrupulous opportunist, a win-at-all-cost schemer. And yet, on the other hand, it is undeniable that he was the king who brought unity and peace and prosperity. And it was because he did that that he was remembered not as an opportunist so much or as a man of violence, but as a king after God's own heart. Because through him, through all the shadows, there had come the blessing promised to Abraham and to his descendants. David was also one who received the promise of an eternal throne. And this was really a promise of an endless unity and peace and prosperity. And that promise, strangely but magnificently, was fulfilled, we say and believe, in the figure of Jesus of Nazareth, who comes riding on the royal donkey and is acclaimed as the Son of David.
And you were listening there to Scripture scholar Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Brisbane in Australia. A feature produced for the series focusing on our family tree of faith by the title of Blood, Sweat and Tears in the Bible. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, Vatican Radio.